Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. School districts across the country have been hit with massive budget cuts. In 2010, here in San Francisco, schools lost a whopping $113 million. So what happens when taxes no longer fund public education? Well, in many cases, parents step in. According to a new report from the San Francisco Public Press, parent fundraising for elementary education in San Francisco has skyrocketed 800% over the past 10 years. This funding has saved classroom programs and teaching positions at schools, but it has also widened the gap between the rich and poor. The report's author and today's guest, Jeremy Adam Smith, reports that budget cuts perpetuate inequity. Affluent families are able to make up for lost funding by donating both time and money, whereas schools with poor families struggle to fill the gap. And this is becoming widely acknowledged as one of the major problems facing public education today. According to former U.S. Secretary of Labor Robert Reich, parent fundraising has become more important as state and local funds are dwindling. So how common is this? Do you see this in your community? What are the best solutions for creating a public education system that is equitable for all children, regardless of wealth or background? And what are some alternative models? Jeremy Adam Smith is author of the article Public Schools, Private Money in the latest edition of the San Francisco Public Press. Their entire new issue is dedicated to education. He's also a fellow with the Institute for Justice and Journalism, and he edits the website of UC Berkeley's Greater Good Science Center. He's the author of several books, including Rad Dad, Dispatches from the Frontiers of Fatherhood. And Jeremy joins me in studio. Hi, Jeremy. Thanks for coming in.
Great to be here.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Marla Stevenson, superintendent of the Albany Unified School District. When Marla took her post in 2008, she noticed inequity among the district's three elementary schools. So in 2011, she initiated a successful system of pooled funding to address this problem. And Marla joins us from Albany. Hi, Marla. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you. So, Jeremy, why don't you lay out what we're facing here? We're not talking about just bake sales anymore. I mean, those still go on, but this is much bigger than bake sales.
Yeah, that's right. You know, what's in effect happened is that, the traditional image that we have of parent-teacher association are a group of moms getting together and having a bake sale, that's sort of the classic thing, and raising some money, oftentimes for gifts for teachers or field trips or, you know, certain special activities. Activities like that. Unfortunately, that view of PTA fundraising is obsolete, at least in San Francisco and in a lot of other major metropolitan areas that have seen budget cuts. We were the first to gather together all of the tax records of the legally recognized PTAs in the area. We added them up, and what we found is that since 2002, PTA budgets have increased by 800%. And what's interesting from a San Francisco perspective is that really started to accelerate when the recession hit and when the budget cuts started. And we found, when we looked at this, that approximately 10 schools in the district in San Francisco Unified were raising half the money out of 71 schools. So that means that, you know, you have funds being concentrated in a few schools where affluent parents cluster. And we looked at the relationship between PTA budgets and parent affluence, using free and reduced lunch measures as a proxy. And we found that poverty predicted PTA budget. There's no ambiguity here.
And not that surprising, right?
I mean, No, of course not.
You find that the parents of children at just those 10 schools raised almost $3 million.
Yeah, that's right.
More money than those at the other 61 combined.
Well, and it's important to say that this stuff is not straightforward. We only looked, for the sake of analytical clarity and apple-to-apple comparisons, at the legally recognized parent-teacher associations. In fact, philanthropy comes into individual schools from lots of different directions. So if anything, our report underestimates these amounts, but it was simply too big and too complex a task to add it all up.
So what other sources of funding are we talking about? Like corporations giving money to schools or nonprofits or what?
Oh, yes. And I am hoping in my next report to look at the impact of corporate philanthropy on San Francisco public schools. I suspect probably that favors technology and charter schools, but that's a question we'll need to investigate later. But that's a good example.
So why don't we talk about a specific example? Because your son briefly attended both Junipero Sarah Elementary.
Or J. Sarah, to its
name. Sarah Elementary in Bernal Heights and Grattan Elementary in The Haight in San Francisco. Both are public schools. Both had no choice but to deal with budget cuts like every other school.
Right.
But when you look at what happened when parents stepped in to fundraise, the problems did not hit both schools equally.
That's right. Well, so it Groton, 21% of the students qualify for free and reduced lunch. And I should say, for those who are not familiar with this, that you have to be very poor to qualify for free and reduced lunch, especially in a city like San Francisco.
How poor?
Well, for a family of four, you need to be making around $42,000 or less a year.
For a family of four?
For a family of four, that's right. So, you know, listeners just need to sort of imagine what that would be like. And we live in a city now where during the past year, during 2013, the average rent on a two-bedroom apartment increased by $1,000. That's gentrification in a nutshell. And what I found is that this report is really a lens. And through that lens, you can see two things happening. You can see the forces of gentrification. In other words, you can see this change in neighborhoods. You can see, you know, an increasing number of wealthy families coming in. But you can also see the force of immigration. You can see the force of the recession and the fact that so many people are struggling with the cost of living. And this has created inequities.
So in order to qualify for a reduced or free lunch, with a family of four, you have to make less than $42,000
yes.
a year. How many students qualify for this in San Francisco?
In San Francisco, it's 62% right now.
Wow.
Now, that is a 10% increase since the start of the recession.
62%?
Yeah, 62%. So San Francisco public schools have been becoming poorer during precisely the time when a lot of educators were asking them to fundraise to make up for budget shortfalls, which I think is a very cruel reality.
And Marla, how common is this in Albany or just in also just the surrounding area? I'm trying to get a sense of how common parent fundraising is really across the country. And Jeremy said that he's only starting to see national papers like the New York Times touch on this issue. But do you know how pervasive this is?
Well, I think that San Francisco Bay Area is a microcosm of the entire nation. When we undertook our equity discussion with our elementary schools, we heard as far from New Jersey, folks that were grappling with the same issue, but in a very quiet way. It's a very politically sensitive subject.
Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. Well, you know that our public schools are operated by state financing, public financing, but the boards that that run the schools are elected political officials, and they have a constituency. So when there's not enough money to fund your public schools and you have the machines of you know, parent teachers associations then stepping in and raising funds, these are the board's constituents, and it becomes very difficult to say no to highly connected, powerful PTAs who want to raise money for the greater good of education, but then create in their own way greater inequality in the public schools.
So going back to this specific example, J. Sarah Elementary in Bernal Heights and Groton Elementary in The Hate, you found, Jeremy, that J. Sarah's principal was forced to lay off staff and freeze supply purchases for a year. We're talking about basic things like
pencils and paper.
Yeah. And then Groton Elementary's principal, because they had so much more money, were able to hire new staff, expand academic programs, and that in turn raised standardized test scores. So the Groton PTA was able to raise about $1,000 per pupil, and at J. Sarah, they were only able to raise $25 per pupil. I mean, that's a massive disparity.
Well, this is a good time to talk about something really important, and I know that some this is on the minds of some of your listeners. So San Francisco actually has a very progressive way of funding its schools. It's called the weighted student formula. And what so they have a base rate. It's around $3,000 this past year. And then they add on more money for kids who have free and reduced lunch, for the number of English language learners at a school, for the number of special ed kids at a school. So the great they try to assess the school's needs, and then they give the school more money based on that. And J. Sarah actually does get more money from the district. And that is a great thing about San Francisco. I support it. We all need to understand it. However, we also need to understand that J. Sarah students really do have greater needs than do Groton's. You know, this is a 90% immigrant population school. This is a school where 86% of the kids qualify for free and reduced lunch, and we've already talked about how indicative that is of poverty. This is a school where a lot of the students have special education needs. This is a school where a lot of the kids don't have computers at home, and if they don't learn to use them in school, they're not going to learn to use them. They're going to arrive, as Evelyn Chung, the principal, pointed out to me, very far behind in middle school and high school if they don't provide that foundational education. So, you know, this is a school with enormous needs, and that's why San Francisco Unified gives them more funds. Now, here's the problem. Well, there's a couple of problems inherent in this. One is that, you know, when they have to lay off special education teachers, when they have to lay off what the district calls consultancies, you know, outside people who come in and help with, for example, arts programs or computer programs, that creates tremendous disruption in the school. And you know, and hits these services that the students really, really need. Also, a school like JCERA, you know, there's higher turnover among the employees because the student population is so depressed. And, you know, the rules are that, you know, layoffs are made according to seniority. So if you have a school that with more distressed students where the employees have less seniority, they're going to get hit first with layoffs when there are budget cuts. Okay, so, and then, you know, you go over to Groton. Okay, so Groton's also facing budget cuts, but what their PTA was able to raise enough money to donate to the general fund so that they did not have any layoffs. That's an important point. That creates safety, stability, continuity in a school, and JCERA did not have that. They were also able to pay for all or part of the salaries of 6 staff people. Okay, so does that make Groton a bad school? Absolutely not. That makes Groton a good school. And, you know, they're blessed with a really active, affluent parent community. But the reality is, and we have to grapple with this reality, the educational experience of the students at Groton is totally different than the students at JCERA. You know, and it's because the two communities are so different and are facing such different stressors, as social scientists like to say.
So when you looked at all of the schools in San Francisco and found that fundraising by parents for elementary education has skyrocketed 800% over the past 10 years, I'm assuming you included this example because it was so stark.
Yeah.
But how common is this example?
Well, you know, throughout the district, poverty has been rising, as we were talking about earlier. And throughout the district, the number of immigrant students, the number of English language student learners has been rising. And we found absolutely that PTA budgets were correlated with, you know, the level of poverty, the number of English language learners. There's no ambiguity here. Now, you know, people have said to me, we've gotten a lot of feedback on the report, and a lot of people feel that maybe some of these schools just aren't mobilized enough. Maybe if they were better organized, then maybe they could raise these funds. I consider this to be straight out blaming the victim. You know, I think that it's pretty clear that the affluence of the families predicts PTA budgets. It's pretty clear that a large PTA budget can save the school from layoffs and can help expand academic programs. And, you know, and it's a philosophical problem. You either have a problem with that or you don't. And, you know, and that's the question we have to ask ourselves now that we know how important PTA fundraising has become.
And Marla, what can you tell us about what you witnessed when you began working for the district in Albany in 2008? I should say Albany. It's a city of about 18,500 people northwest of Berkeley in Alameda County. And according to the report in SF Public Press, many families moved there because of the reputation of the school district. 3 elementary schools, Marin, Cornell, and Ocean View. And you're quoted in this piece saying that if you were to walk onto all 3 elementary campuses, you would find vastly different programs within the school day. I would walk onto the Marin School site. I would find that chess classes were being offered to students. I would go to Cornell. I would see music lessons by professional vocalists being offered. That's great. And then the 3rd school was notably different. You said you would go to Ocean View and you would see nothing happening. How surprising was that to you?
Well, I think it was a shock, to be honest with you, because when you first look at all 3 elementary schools, you see very similar, very high-performing district test scores, all very similar, and we're 1.5 square miles. So when you think about a neighborhood school, all 3 schools could conceivably be neighborhood schools. But what I was seeing was that one school in particular, Marin, followed by Cornell, had a waiting list to get into the schools, whereas Ocean View, being our more economically diverse population. More EL learners definitely our highest free and reduced lunch count was the least preferred school in the district. So when you would walk in, and you know, we have an approved curriculum, we provide the same amount of funding to all children, yet you would walk onto one school and I would see things going on that I know that we hadn't approved. That I had no idea that chess was being taught, and that's not a bad thing. Chess is wonderful. At one school, we would have art infused throughout the day at Marin. We, as I said before in the report, Cornell had a very strong music program, and I was shocked. So how did all this happen during the school day? Who was funding it? And why didn't it come to the district and be approved by the school board? And herein lies the big problem, I think, with almost every public school district. PTAs have changed radically over the years, especially over the last 6 years. And where they were on the periphery doing very small, wonderful things to build community at each school site, some of the PTAs have turned into real money-making machines. And working outside of the school district, they were directly funding educational enrichment within the school day. And that creates an inequity that cannot be tolerated. We have to provide a free and appropriate public school education for all children. And it's got to be equitable at each site. So when I first, you know, became aware of this, my immediate response was, well, gosh, we just won't approve them at the board level. So I told each principal, no matter what the program was, it needed to come through the district and be approved by the school board, because that's part of our board policy, gifts, grants, and bequests. You have to have every dollar that comes into the school, individual school, approved by the school board. When I did that, I didn't realize the can of worms that I was opening. Hmm. Because, of course, where do parents go if they are unhappy? If they can't have their favorite music program or their favorite art program, they go directly to the school board. I came as close to losing my job as I've ever come before, just on that one thing, which says we will make sure that equity occurs amongst all three schools, and we'll do it by not approving programs at one school if they can't be replicated at another school.
So how did you deal with that?
Well, you know, after I realized that I didn't have total board support on this, it became more of a more, you know, it was politics, and the politics of trying to accomplish something, it takes a lot more time, and you realize it cannot be accomplished through the denial of programs. What you need to do is you need to figure out how you can provide programs equitably across the board. It was extremely volatile and very sensitive. Parents pitted against parents in meeting after meeting, and we had to come to a common agreement that these were all of our kids, not just a Marin kid or an Ocean View kid or a Cornell kid, but they were Albany Unified's kids. And over the course of 2 years, we were able to put together a good start. We have not completed this task by any measure. We have agreed to do blind fundraising at all three schools. So the giving campaign is not tracked by each site. It goes into one pot of money, then divided up by the enrollment of each site, and then distributed back with a very clear idea of what we approve in the curriculum. But then they have the freedom to choose amongst a menu of enrichment that occurs within the school day. That doesn't, though, tackle the issue that I think is even overarching that, and that is, well, the amount of fundraising that goes to improve facilities, to add staff, to build community, to buy computers, all of those things, we haven't really addressed. We only took on the most vital and critical element for me, which is to provide the same opportunities for children within the school day.
That is Marla Stevenson. She's superintendent of the Albany Unified School District. When she took that post in 2008, she noticed inequity among the district's three elementary schools. And in 2011, she initiated a system of pooled funding to address the problem. We're also joined by Jeremy Adam Smith. He's author of the piece Public Schools, Private Money in the latest edition of the San Francisco Public Press. And it takes a look at what happens when parents raise money for public education. Here in San Francisco, parent fundraising has skyrocketed 800% over the past 10 years. And he points out massive inequities. In one case, one school has $1,000 per student. Another school has $25 per student. So we'd love to hear from you on this issue. If you're active in your PTA, talk about your experience. What changes have you seen over the past couple of years? If your child or someone you know knows goes to a school that does have funding thanks to a very active PTA with resources, we'd love to hear from you. And if your child goes to a school, or if you know someone who goes to a school with a PTA that isn't very active and isn't able to raise that much money, what are you seeing? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. How long can this last? I mean, what happens at the wealthy schools if their parents' stock portfolio crashes or something, right? I mean, how do you maintain this? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Alex in San Francisco. Hi, Alex. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I think the crux of the matter is that people who work in cities like San Francisco, for example, spend their money somewhere else, and they buy their million, multi-million dollar homes in suburbia. And the fact that education is financed by property tax makes it impossible for cities to compete with the suburbia. Therefore, my suggestion is property tax should be collected not by local governments, but by the state. And then the state should equitably distribute the money to schools throughout the state per capita basis. That would solve the problem, and the people running to suburbs for special privileges, that would stop, and perhaps we would have an equal distribution of resources.
Well, thank you for calling. Well, you know, whenever we do shows about what's happening in California, Prop 13 comes up. And according to the website Close the Loophole, according to the California Budget Project, immediately prior to the passage of Prop 13, local revenues provided almost half of the funding for public schools in California. With Prop 13 in place, schools are forced to rely on Sacramento for most of their funding. And as we know, revenue has not kept up with what the schools need.
Yeah.
So what are your thoughts on that before we go to break, Jeremy? About 30 seconds. we can talk about it after the break, too.
Yeah, well, let me first say that it is absolutely positively impossible to talk about property taxes, and state funding of education in 30 seconds. So I'm not even going to try.
Well, I'm just saying we're going to break in 30 seconds, but we can talk about it after the break.
Okay, great. Yeah. It's immensely complex, and you know, but I think maybe the most important thing to say is that the state recently changed its system. They're moving to something called the local control funding formula, and that is a good thing. It's sort of the statewide equivalent of San Francisco's weighted student formula, where high need districts with a lot of poverty, a lot of English language learners, are going to be getting more funding, and San Francisco Unified is going to be getting more funding.
Okay, and we'll talk about that after the break. There's a lot of interest on this because we've got full lines right now, and we're talking today about what happens when parents fund public education. If this is happening in your area, we'd love to hear from you. What inequities are you seeing when one school is able to raise $1,000 per child and another school is only able to raise $25 per child? We'll be back after this.
This is your call on Local Public Radio, 91.7 FM, KALW, San Francisco. If you have a perspective that you'd like to share that you have not yet heard in today's discussion, or a question you feel ought to be answered, please join the conversation by calling this number, 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free call. You can also send an email question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org or simply post a comment at that site, yourcallradio.org. Coming up in 30 minutes at 11 o'clock, the BBC's World Have Your Say.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, Hanna Baba will have a conversation about what it means to eat out responsibly. We'll talk about the restaurant industry, which employs 13 million people and is responsible for six of the lowest paying job categories, according to the Labor Department. Some restaurants are making an effort to pay and treat workers fairly. So what do you want to know about the restaurant industry and eating out ethically? That is tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are talking about what happens when parents fund public education. This is a growing trend across the country. A new report from the San Francisco Public Press found that parent fundraising for elementary education in San Francisco has skyrocketed 800% over the past 10 years. The funding has saved programs, teaching positions, field trips, you name it, but it's also widened the gap between the rich and the poor. And we're talking about this today with Jeremy Adam Smith. He is author of the article, Public Schools, Private Money. He's also a fellow with the Institute for Justice and Journalism and author of Rad Dad, Dispatches from the Frontiers of Fatherhood. Marla Stevenson is superintendent of the Albany Unified School District. When she took that position in 2008, she noticed a major inequity among the district's three elementary schools. And in 2011, it was incredibly difficult, but she initiated a successful system of pooled funding to address the problem. And Marla, what are your thoughts on Alex's call about property taxes really being the issue here?
Well, I think that it's strictly speaking property taxes. Prop 13 certainly was the beginning of the end of California's lead in providing quality education throughout the system. What we're really dealing with now is a lack of funding. Even though we're talking about, you know, Prop 39 passing, the governor really making education a major part of his budget package, our funding level is just now approaching what we had in our schools in 2008. So when we talk about funding and we talk about equalization funding or weighted student formula, which is what the governor is proposing, until we can have, I think until the funding increases, to where we can provide a quality education for all kids, parent fundraising is not going to go away.
So where do you see this going? Because we just found a piece in the New York Times by Elaine Salerno Mason, a book editor in New York City, and she wrote, "Fed up with fundraising for my kid's school. I'm not talking about making cupcakes for the bake sale. At my school in Upper Manhattan, the PTA pays for professional development. Parents have set up a 501c3 nonprofit to raise money. Without it, the school would have no art. There would be no science. We wouldn't have the Junior Great Books Literacy Program." She said that the parents raised $185,000 last year to pay for all of this. There'd be no prep course for eighth graders taking high school admissions tests. She says the holes parents are being asked to fill keep getting deeper. So do you just think this is going to continue?
As long as we continue to underfund public education, yes, it will continue. And quite frankly, you know, we are 48th in the nation in school funding, even with the proposed increases by Governor Brown's budget. We're still under $6,500 per student in terms of total funding. If you look at New Jersey or Massachusetts, their funding level is closer to $12,000-$13,000 per student.
Well, we've got a number of callers on the line, so let's go next to Daniel in Albany. Hi, Daniel. Welcome to the show. Do we have Daniel? Well, Daniel wanted to thank you, Marla, for the work that you're doing in education. Daniel, you can give us a call back if you're still listening. Let's go next to Susanna in San Francisco. Hi, Susanna. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I am a parent at Clarendon Elementary School in San Francisco, And when we were got accepted to Clarendon, we felt like we won a lottery ticket.
Okay, so on that, Susanna, before you move on, for people who aren't familiar with how the system works, what do you mean when you were so thrilled when you got into the school?
There are some excellent public elementary schools in San Francisco, quite a few. And then there are some where you wouldn't really feel comfortable, or I should say I wouldn't feel comfortable sending my kid. The schools that are known as the gems, the usual suspects, include Clarendon, West Portal, Claire Lilienthal, Argonne. There's like a handful that are very coveted spaces. And these you cannot buy your way into. You cannot apply your way into. It's a lottery system. And that system has been adjusted somewhat in the last several years, where it's moving back towards more of a neighborhood system, where the place you live has a weighted average where you're more likely to get into the school down the block. But there are many stories of people who applied for the school across the street and didn't get in.
Right. Well, and again, this means, because I have a friend who did this, and he and his partner had to spend a lot of time visiting these schools. So, I mean, if you're a family that's working two or three jobs and you just don't have the time, there's no possible way that you can get involved with this lottery system.
I would call it an invisible inequity. It's a matter of the flexibility that you have in your job. It's a matter of your language skills, and a lot of San Francisco families do not have the language skills to negotiate the system. And I should say San Francisco Unified is good about being, I would say, trilingual or maybe even quadrilingual. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that's a barrier for a lot of families. And, you know, and also just organizational skills and education, you know, and it's the families that have those things, and God bless them, you know, they can persist until they get the school that they want. That's just a fact. And you can see that. The fact of the matter is we have a lot of schools in San Francisco that have very high concentrations of poverty. We also have a small number of schools that have relatively high concentrations of wealth. And that is that. Those are the facts.
So, Susanna, your child goes to Clarendon Elementary, and I understand they have an active PTA? Oh, she's gone. Okay, sorry about that, Susanna. But thank you for calling in. We have Daniel in Albany back. Hi, Daniel. Welcome to the show.
Hi, sorry about that. I'm a proud Albany parent. All three of my kids have gone through Cornell, and you know, where I'm one of those families that live in Albany, and we've got a family of five living in a two-bedroom apartment, crammed in there because we want to be in that school district. And we moved in 2007, and 2011 I watched via video online one of the longest school board meetings I've ever seen, as one parent after another came to argue the case with their kid in their school, right? The kids in Marin wanted to keep...
Daniel? Oh, sorry, Daniel. You're on a cell phone, I think, and we just lost you. Sorry about that. Let's hear from Ann in San Francisco. Hi, Ann. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
I'm a parent at George Peabody Elementary School in the Richmond District, and I, too, felt like I won the lottery when our son got in. It's not our neighborhood school. I've been extremely active in the school. Our PTA does raise a lot of money, but I think the basic problem that I have is that the district doesn't fund these schools with even the basics. And I think that all children should get the basics, no matter if they are from one socioeconomic background or another. And so the PTAs have been forced, and I don't think they should be criticized or ever put down for the effort that they have made over the last 10 years. Mm. And I can see why there's 800% increase, because these schools don't have the basics.
What do you mean when you say the basics?
So our PTA bought school supplies this year.
Huh. Yeah, that's what so many teachers do that.
That's basic. And you know what? We give our teachers stipends, because teachers don't make enough money to buy their own supplies.
Right.
So we, as a PTA, are supplying them with stipends. And, yes, we do pay for professional development, and I think it was somebody that you quoted from New York. I mean, it is very interesting. I mean, we are, you know, what, the seventh or eighth largest GMP in the world in the state of California, and Michigan funds has, I think, twice or three times the amount per student than we do. I mean, we know that New Jersey and other states, but when we are 48th in the nation, and we are the seventh or the eighth largest GMP. There's something seriously wrong with this. But I don't think that anybody should fault the PTAs at any school when these parents step in. I mean, I'm working with people that have jobs. I have a company. I have a job. I have a mother that I take care of, a son. I have a husband. We all have things that are going on in our life, but we all take the time out to put in to our schools and our PTAs to make them a better place because the basics are not taking place by the district or the state.
And Anne, let me ask you, how sustainable do you think this is? I mean, are you and others that you work with in the PTA willing to do this year after year after year?
Well, I mean, that draws a big question, and it's really hard work. And I think that in any fundraising, no matter who you're fundraising for, you will see, you know, peaks and valleys. And so I'm not sure. Now we have brought our school up to a level where a new parent said to me, you know, a couple of years ago when you came in, my son's in fourth grade, your parents really drove to make this a better place. And now the people that are coming in, some of them are expecting, hey, look, this is a great school. Let's go to it. And so we'll see. I mean, I think that we'll see in the next couple of years, are we able to sustain what we've been doing? And do I think it's hard on parents? Yes, I do. But if you really want to think about it, the fundraising that you quote at Grattan, you know, that's less than probably 1 month of preschool for the majority of parents in San Francisco. And so in the scheme of things, they're giving a small amount to what they have been paying. Do I think it's fair? No, absolutely not. Do I think that public education should be equal for all people? Yes, absolutely. But it's not. So I think that the PTAs who have stepped up and have really, you know, given their kids the best thing they possibly can, I congratulate all of them. And I wish that the school district, we just got our budget. It's lower this year.
Mm.
Well, here we go again.
Well, thanks so much for calling in, Anne. Jeremy, your response?
Well, she covered a lot of ground.
Yeah.
I have a couple of responses. One is that, you know, absolutely the PTA should not be blamed. Parents who are working so hard to raise money for their children's school, I think, the way I think of it is that it's a hostage situation. You know, they're basically, essentially what the state is doing is putting a gun to the heads of their children and saying, fundraise or else. And, you know, and if you don't have the resources to do that, then you're going to feel a little bit helpless. I actually think that these budget cuts have been traumatizing for a lot of families. And maybe that sounds melodramatic to some, but I think that if you're really in the school system and you're really seeing what's happening, you'll understand that it's not an exaggeration. You know, people were very, very distressed to see their schools losing staff. They were very distressed to hear that the school couldn't afford to buy pencils and papers that year. That is distressing. You fear for your child's future when you hear things like that happening. And, you know, if there's a group of affluent parents who get together and, you know, bring all the resources that they can to save their school, great. But we have to understand that that has a larger impact and that it's occurring in a larger context. And that's very hard to do. You know, we as parents, and I feel it. I'm a parent and I get it. You know, you become so focused on your own child and your own child's needs that you forget about other people's children. And you forget that your problems, the problems you're facing are oftentimes faced by many other families, but they bring a lot less to the table in dealing with them.
And Marla, after you initiated a successful system of pooled funding to address this problem, how did that affect the school you visited? It was the Ocean School, Ocean View.
Ocean View, yes.
And you saw nothing happening, whereas at the other schools, music classes, chess. How did that change things?
Well, I think you could walk onto any campus now and see the same type of enrichment occurring in the school day at all three campuses. The one thing I'd like to just point out, you know, that caller had an important point to make. PTAs and parents should not be blamed. The key of PTA and parent involvement is to create a fabric of community. And that's one of the reasons that we kept all three PTAs very much intact. They continue to fundraise for field trips and, you know, the little extras for students and assemblies and the like. You don't want to take the autonomy of each site's PTA away from them. So parents need to be congratulated and encouraged to continue to participate in the public school education. We need all parents and all children, you know, in the system in order to really fulfill what our great democracy is all about, which is the great equalization of opportunity in the education of all students.
That is Marla Stevenson, superintendent of the Albany Unified District. She initiated a system of pooling funding to address inequity among the district's three elementary schools. Jeremy Adam Smith is author of the piece Public Schools, Private Money in the latest edition of the San Francisco Public Press, which looks at what happens when parents fund public education. Here in San Francisco, that has skyrocketed 800% over the past 10 years because of massive, massive budget cuts. And let's go through a few calls and then we'll get responses because we have so many. We have Daniel back, who has a better line now. Hi, Daniel. Welcome to the show, or welcome back.
Hi, guys. Sorry about that. Yeah, one of the things I remember from the 2011 brouhaha was that somebody said that the PTA at Ocean View raised as much money as it does at the one at Marin, but that because the students at Ocean View had a larger population of ESL students, they had a priority, had to divert more money towards those programs rather than extracurriculars like music. Hmm. And then another former board member said to me, well, there's a reason there's more ESL and poor students at Ocean View, and that is because you need a minimum percentage of them, of kids below a certain income at a school to qualify for this particular kind of federal grant. And that shocked me, the idea of pouring more poor kids into one school to get federal money. Talk about a hostage situation.
Well, actually, let's comment on that, because that would be a tough one to take in a couple minutes. Jeremy, do you want to, you just were shaking your head. Do you want to comment on that?
Well, I don't have much to say. I believe what he's referring to is Title I funding. And yes, absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, we have to ask ourselves a lot of hard questions about the neurotic way that we have funded schools and the sort of crazy things that school districts do in order to qualify funding. And I actually think it's gotten a lot better. You know, there's an anecdote that gets passed around San Francisco Unified about the district getting dinged by the state because teachers from one program used a water cooler that had been bought by funds for another program, and so they were ruled as being not in compliance. Now, I've heard this directly from Board of Education members, so I assume it's true and not apocryphal, but that's kind of a good example of just the knots that people tie themselves into. And, you know, the bottom line is that our schools are underfunded. They're all underfunded. They all need more funding. And, you know, carving things up this way and pitting schools against each other and causing them to make these kind of crazy counterproductive decisions, It overall, it just hurts the system and it hurts the children's education.
Marla, do you have anything to add?
Well, in Albany in particular, we do not have schools of residence or neighborhood schools. So every child that is at a particular school is there for a reason. It just so happens that Ocean View is in an area where there is a higher incidence of children on free and reduced lunch. But they have the opportunity to go to any of the three schools.
All right. Well, thanks again for calling. Let's go back to Susanna in San Francisco. Hi, Susanna.
Hey, I just want to thank you guys for the work you're doing, and I want to point out that the reality in San Francisco is that we can't do the Albany system. We don't have two rich schools and one poor school. Mm. We have a handful of wealthy schools and a lot of underfunded schools, and if we were to institute the same program that was done in Albany, the money would be so spread so thin from the PTAs that nobody would get anything, and I think what would happen is that the more wealthy parents would just say, hey, I'm going to pull my kid and send them to private school. And all of that money would leave the district and go into the private system. And I agree that all schools are underfunded. But until we can get it so that all schools get the money they need, what do you have to say about that?
Well, you know, first of all, I actually want to amplify something that Marla said earlier, which is that, you know, the original mission of PTAs is to build community amongst the parents and between the parents and the teachers. And, you know, the story The sort of sub-story to the story we told is that San Francisco school communities have become increasingly organized. I mean, we're seeing more and more registered, legally recognized parent-teacher associations, and those parent-teacher associations are a lot more active. And they've turned their energies to, you know, raising a lot of money, and we tried to document how that creates inequities in the system. The experience in Albany... And also, we also looked at the Santa Monica Malibu School District, which has a similar system in place. Again, smaller than San Francisco, about one-fifth the size. The thing that we kept hearing as we looked at these school districts is that a lot of the parents who had previously opposed the change of sharing fundraising, of working together to raise philanthropic funds for the schools, actually realized on the other side of it that it was really wonderful. And not everybody feels this way. You know, I don't want to sell it as some utopian scheme. But, you know, a lot of them realized on the other side of things that this was actually a better way to do things for a couple of reasons. One is that it actually takes some of the burden off of them. They are sharing more in the burden of fundraising for the schools. They're getting support from the district. Two, they feel good about it. You know, inequality, inequity doesn't feel good for the affluent. It makes you feel bad. When you look at somebody who has less than you do, when you see them struggling, when you yourself are comfortable, when you look at your own children, they have advantages that other children don't have, we feel bad. And that's because human beings are wonderfully social creatures. We're very exquisitely tuned to other people's suffering. And when you're and this is something else Marla talked about earlier, you know, when you frame the children of a school district as all being in the same boat, and when you frame it as, you know, doing something for the whole and not just for yourself and for your kids, when you bring people together, that feels good.
So this is in place in Santa Monica and Malibu. Mm-hmm. Do you think this could ever happen in a place like San Francisco?
Right. Well, I think it would be very hard. You know, yeah. San Francisco Unified is an intensely political place. Nobody I interviewed said it would be possible. They all felt like it would be totally impossible.
You do have in your report 10 solutions to inequality in fundraising. One is individuals can donate to edmatchsf.org or urge their employers to do so.
Yeah.
That'll channel money to the neediest schools.
Yep.
Parents can match contributions they make to their own child's school with additional gifts to a poorer school. Does that really happen?
I talked to parents who at least considered it. I never talked to somebody who... I hadn't thought of that myself. These parents brought it up to me that they had talked about it. Or at least one person said, yeah, my wife and I talked about that. We were really excited about doing it. And then we got caught up in fundraising for our own school and that fell to the wayside. Individuals can make that choice. It's not going to make a big difference unless the school district or the PTAs show some leadership and help make it happen.
All right. Well, let's go back to calls. We have time for a few more. Let's go to Alan in San Martin. Hi, Alan. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. A couple of points I wanted to make. I find it that the whole notion of punishing or penalizing school and the parents who are trying to raise funds for their school, I think we're overlooking the fact that within a individual school, there is a lot of inequities already. In the case of San Martin, we have a local elementary school that's very diverse economically, a lot of second language students. And the fact is that we raised funds for our school, and it helped all those students. And that philosophy of inequity in the case of donations, private donations from parents, I'm having a hard time understanding this sense of some somehow of entitlement of private to individuals trying to fund their local community organization. It just doesn't make sense. That's all I wanted to say.
Well, this raises a question. How many schools are actually economically diverse? And you found that fewer and fewer schools, at least here in San Francisco, are attracting economically diverse students.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny that I hear a lot of people assert otherwise. But, you know, for example, you know, the number of schools where more than 3/4 of the students qualify for free and reduced lunch. So these are high concentrations of poverty in these schools. That number has tripled since the start of the recession. So, you know, in the year 2000, there were just 5 schools that were that poor. Today, that number is 18. So this number of schools where poverty is really concentrated has tripled in the past 10 years. And that's a very serious social issue.
And the lottery system is supposed to keep schools racially and economically diverse, but the data suggests that it's largely failed.
Another thing that I just, you know, this is such a hot button issue. You know, they use economics as a proxy for, you know, other kinds of diversity. And this is the result of a series of court decisions. Very complex. The system actually has changed in the past 2 years. And, you know, and we'll see if it succeeds in making schools a little bit more diverse.
We could actually do a whole show on that.
We could do a whole show. I think you should.
Rose called in, but we don't have time. Sorry about that, Rose. But Rose wanted to say low-income parents cannot afford to volunteer as much as high-income parents.
Yes.
And I was just talking with someone yesterday who spends a lot of time on these issues and says, the other thing is parents are coming in to act almost as teachers.
Yes.
For kids who, you know, English is their second language, or
yes,
kids who need extra help. So you've got highly educated, mostly stay-at-home mothers who volunteer at the school.
Yes, absolutely.
Are you seeing that on the rise?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, and there's a lot of anecdotal information about this. I mean, a lot of teachers say this, like long-term veteran teachers say that they just see parents in the classrooms a heck of a lot more, and they're often affluent parents, of course.
So 30 seconds, where is this going and what are the solutions to make this more equitable?
Well, you know, I don't know exactly what the solutions are for San Francisco Unified.
But for just in general, we're seeing a trend across the country.
Right. Well, you know, first of all, a couple of people have mentioned that the bottom line is taxes and making sure that we make a commitment to the future of our country's children. You know, and I don't speak to any, I haven't spoken to one leader anywhere who said equity is a bad thing, or we don't want our children to have a good future, or we think education is a bad thing. Very few people say that. You know, this is something we're all committed to, but we have to understand that we need to pay for it.
And Marla, final thoughts from you, 30 seconds.
I'm right along with the majority of the public. We have to increase taxes to adequately fund public education.
Marla Stevenson is superintendent of the Albany Unified School District. In 2011, she initiated a successful system of pooling funding to address the problem of inequity among the district's three elementary schools. Be sure to pick up the latest edition of San Francisco Public Press to read more about what she saw there. And Jeremy Adam Smith is author of the article Public Schools, Private Money, which is also in the latest edition. Thank you both for joining us.
Great to be here.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for calling, and thanks for your emails. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. How can we eat out responsibly? On the next Your Call, we'll talk about the restaurant industry and eating out ethically. The food service industry employs 13 million people in the U.S. and is responsible for 6 of the lowest-paying job categories, according to the Labor Department. Some restaurants are making an effort to pay and treat workers fairly. So what do you want to know about the restaurant industry and eating out ethically? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with Hannah Baba and support you. For Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.